We're back on Downtown. Our next guest burst onto the scene back in 1983, playing the part of Miles Dalby, the best friend of Tom Cruise's Joel character in Risky Business. Along the way, memorable roles as Dudley Booger Dawson in Revenge of the Nerds, Charles DeMar in Better Off Dead, Ack Raymond in One Crazy Summer. He's been in movies like Ray. Recent appearances in some wonderful TV shows, including Supernatural. Of course, his role as Herbert Viola on Moonlighting. He's the author of a terrific memoir and one of our favorite people to talk to on the program. We're happy to welcome Curtis Armstrong back to Downtown.
Oh, thank you very much, Rich.
A lot of things to talk about today, but I wanted to pass along directly our condolences at the loss of your dad earlier this summer.
Yes, thank you very much. It was definitely a difficult time, of course, especially because he died of COVID, which, I mean, it made the entire process, as bad as it was, he was 92, so it was not wholly unexpected that he would have health problems that could lead to that, but the fact that it was COVID meant that we couldn't be with him. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows now that that's a new reality, that as you're not allowed to be in the room, you wind up having to say goodbye remotely, which is just awful. Yeah, so that was about a month ago now, I guess, or a little over a month. But I appreciate your condolences, and I can only hope that this nightmare sees an end to it.
Absolutely. Now, he's the one that introduced you to Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, he did. In 1964, we were living overseas in Switzerland. He'd been transferred there, and there was no television. There was no. We were mainly not allowed to even go to movie theaters in those days that was showing anything but cartoons. So I did a lot of reading from an early age. And at one point I had gone through whatever Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew books I had accessible, and he started giving me his books. And one of the first ones was The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. And it started a love of those books and ultimately that fandom that exist to this day. So, in fact, I was making a list yesterday in my journal, just out of curiosity at this point, since we've had COVID and since we've been essentially locked down, that I was wondering how many books I had read since I've been sort of quarantined or completely quarantined. And it came out to 32 books since I'd say February or March. And one of them was a reread of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. So it really has stuck with me.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, these are difficult times for everybody, but I know so many of my friends that I've worked with in regional theater are in this boat of not knowing when their next job will be. For people like yourselves who do film and television, it's still all up in the air. And the reality is that most working actors go from job to job, and the future is a big question mark right now. What's the biggest challenge of that for you?
I would say, it's an enormous... It's an enormous, stressful reality for everybody in the world. And sometimes I wonder for people who, for reasons like those faced by actors, for example, There are the people who are not working, which is stressful. There are the people who have to work. And for those people, it may be even more stressful. There is in fact, I believe it is more stressful. They have to go to the meatpacking plants. We don't. And so whenever I'm feeling particularly stressed or feeling like I'll never have another job, or, you know, all of those things that occur to you when you've been away from work for a long time, I think about the people who are being forced to do it and forced to go into environments that have sort of perpetuated this plague, and they're doing it because they're essential, and or they have no protection. We are in a position where, you know, eventually, somehow or other, we will probably go back to a sense of normalcy and a sense of, you know, getting production underway again. But it won't be just as easy as saying, okay, we're opening up Hollywood. We do have protections in the unions, particularly for SAG-AFTRA, working very hard, but also the Directors Guild and the Writers Guild. Everybody is working together with production on this to come up with protocols that will keep everyone safe, or as safe as possible, once this does start happening again. So I don't feel like we're as people in my business are necessarily worse off than a lot of people. I think we're in the same boat with everybody. I can't imagine when it's going to change, but, you know, we take it one day at a time. Everybody, you know, the unions are in negotiations with producers about the protocols. That's an ongoing discussion. So we'll just, you know, see where it goes. I just hope everyone else winds up in the same with that same sort of respect for their health and safety, teachers, for example, that actors are going to get.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to finding out what's happening with me. I teach high school, and we're scheduled to go back in 5 or 6 weeks. And while I want to get back, I want to see students and work with them. But I want it to be safe for me, for them, and for their families as well. And it's a scary time. And I don't know anybody who deals well with uncertainty, but I'm not cut out to deal with that particularly well. I like to have a plan.
Right. Well, I mean, and we like to think that someone is taking all of these elements into consideration. There has been, of course, no leadership at all in the federal government. No. And the local and state governments are, you know, to one extent or another, doing what they can. There are extremes on both sides, those that are actually working to do it and those that are just sticking to Trump's belief in just, you know, it going away magically. I think that's all going to change within the next few weeks. I mean, when you're talking 5 or 6 weeks, I can't even imagine where we're going to be, where the condition of the country is going to be in 5 weeks. Just going 3 days seems to change everything now. The teachers concern me a lot. The schools concern me a lot, the students, and it's all intertwined, and we need somebody to take the reins here, and it's not going to be Trump, clearly.
No. We're talking with Curtis Armstrong here on Downtown. Let's talk about happier things. I did not get to see Hamilton on Broadway, but like much of the rest of the world, I was glued to my television a couple of weeks ago when it debuted on Disney+. I was absolutely blown away by it, and I was so it was so heartwarming to read the story that was shared on social media by a friend of yours who worked with you on King of the Nerds. Right. Anthony Carbone told a tremendous story about you, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and friend of our show, Joanne Freeman. Can you relate some of that story? Because it was wonderful.
Well, it went back to when I was doing an episode of House, Hugh Laurie's show, and Lynn and I had been cast in it. It was a season premiere. It was a 2-hour episode where House had been put into a hospital. And Lynn played one of the other, Lynn and I both played other residents of this hospital. And I happened to be reading, this is years ago now, and before anyone knew anything about Hamilton. And Lynn, I was reading a book about Aaron Burr called Fallen Founder by Nancy Eisenberg. And it's a biography of Aaron Burr, which I read because I'm interested in American history. And I had been reading it on the set, and I put it down on my chair and walked away. And a few minutes later, heard a scream across the soundstage, and it was Lynn saying, "Whose book is this? Whose book is this?" And I came over and I said, "It's mine." And then he started in on talking about how he was working on a musical based on Alexander Hamilton. And so we started talking about that, and it was all very funny. And then he, the next day, brought in his laptop and gave me headphones, and I listened to some of his basic sort of demos from Hamilton, which were astonishing. But it was a strange thing because, of course, I was not listening to them in the context of the play.
Right.
And so years later, obviously, it opens
Richard Rogers Theater.
The Public Theater, which I didn't see. I didn't see it when it was there. But then it was on Broadway. And I was there with my wife. We got tickets. And I mentioned it on Twitter that I was going. And I didn't realize that Lynn was following me on Twitter, but he was. And he said, "Oh, you have to come backstage," and blah, blah, blah. So after the show, and Anthony happened to be there. We didn't even know he was there. We went backstage. We went to the side, to the backstage door. And there were, you know, crowds of people waiting to see Lynn, and he went through all of them. It was great. And then he was talking to us. He said, "Listen," and I was with Elaine. So it's Elaine, me, and Anthony. And Lynn said, "You have to come with me because I'm going to a bar to meet Joanne Freeman, who is a Hamilton scholar, and you should come." And I said, "Well, I shouldn't. I didn't, you know, we don't want to interrupt." And I remember Elaine just glaring at me, like, "What, are you out of your mind?" And I said, "Okay, we'll go." And so the three of us walk over with Lynn to this bar where Joanne is sitting in a booth. And she had brought with her one of the pamphlets, the original pamphlet, the actual thing that she brought, among other things, as sort of a show and tell thing for Lynn. So we're all sitting at the table with our drinks. Lynn, I believe, was having tea, but the rest of us weren't. And she was passing this around for us. I mean, it was such an amazing experience. And we were there for a couple of hours and then hit the road. But it was one of the memorable nights of my life, I think, because I wound up actually sending Joanne copies of some of Washington Irving's journal about his He had been present at Byrd's trial and wrote, not for publication, in his journal about Aaron Burr, his appearance, you know, just this sort of fly on the wall thing about Burr's trial. And she had not seen it because it had never been published as part of Irving's actual journals. So, you know, that started up a friendship with Joanne. So we're still in touch.
That's wonderful. We love having her on the show, and I could just listen to her talk history all day long. She is amazing. Yeah. That's such a great story.
Joanne makes history come alive, which sounds like, you know, that's sort of a typical thing that people say. In her case, it's actually true.
Absolutely. I want to talk a little Beatles with you while we have you here as well. A couple anniversaries this year, one of them being the 50th anniversary of the release of the final album, Let It Be, which is often looked at askance by some critics as not being among the best Beatles work. How do you view it?
Well, I always have my feeling about Let It Be was always a weird one, because you remember, I mean, technically, of course, it's not the last album. Right. It's the penultimate album, because they did Abbey Road after that. But because of the delays in getting the film out, it was released after Abbey Road, which makes it the last album. But it really wasn't. And so that's one thing. For me, when I first heard Let It Be, I didn't hear that version. Before the album came out, I knew a disc jockey in Detroit, a friend of mine, and he had somehow acquired on a reel-to-reel tape, had acquired the bootleg.
Wow.
Which was called Come Back, K-U-M, Come Back, and it was the rough mix that was ultimately released as Let It Be Naked. Which was, you came out in as Let It Be Naked, you know, whenever it was, 10 years ago or something. And he gave it to me to take home and listen. And my father had a reel-to-reel system. So for me, the first time I ever hear those records was that version. And I knew what the story was. I knew this was them working out tracks for the cameras and all that. So for me, I just thought it was fantastic, because you were sort of listening to them without their pants on, which is how John, I think, described it, without their trousers. And so that was my introduction to the Let It Be album. And then the actual Let It Be album came out. But by the time it came out, we were able to see the movie in cinemas. And to me, it's not like it's my favorite album. I don't know if there's anybody who would say it's their favorite Beatle album. But when you saw it in the context of the movie, that it somehow made it. Some of them worked better than others. I hated all of the choirs and the strings, but some of the stuff like I've Got a Feeling, Two of Us, I Mean Mine, some of those I think work perfectly fine on the record. The main issues I had with it were the overproduced Phil Spector, you know, stuff, which, you know, was to me abhorrent. It didn't feel like the Beatles at all. So it's, you know, it's like when people say, is Yellow Submarine your favorite? It's not, but it doesn't mean that I don't listen to it. In the context of what it was, it's perfectly fine.
Are you looking forward to the Peter Jackson film that I guess now has been delayed till next year?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. There's a book, actually. Wait a second. I've got it here. Hold on. There's a book here. this came out years ago. I don't even know if it's still in print. It's called Get Back, The Unauthorized Chronicle of the Beatles' Let It Be Disaster, which, aside from sort of putting disaster in there, which leans a little heavily on the author's idea, what it really is they got all of the tapes, or a lot of the tapes at the time, so they transcribed everything that was being said. Some of these appeared when Let It Be Naked came out. There was, I don't know if they came out on the CD or not, but I got the vinyl of that, and it was coming with it was this 8-inch vinyl, which was a sort of fly on the wall thing from the Let It Be sessions. And so you went with the book. What's great, the authors were Doug Sulke and Ray Schweigert, or Schweigert, I don't know. and it gives you a really valuable sort of insight into what was going on at the time. And, you know, once you start piecing together all of the stuff that didn't come out in Michael Lindsay Hogg's movie, you begin to see that there were certainly aspects of it that weren't nightmarish and horrible. But when you're making a documentary, you know, you have to come from a perspective. But what made Let It Be funny, I read this not long ago, I think. It was an interview with Michael Lindsay Hogg, who had worked with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And he said the funny thing for him was, the difficult thing was, with the Rolling Stones, if you were filming Rolling Stones, you basically came to them with an idea, and you went to Mick and Charlie. Mick and Charlie were the ones who were in charge of everything. And it was easy, because it was two guys, they either said yes or no, and that was it. They seem to be on the same page. He said, with the Beatles, it's like four lions in a cage, and you throw in a piece of raw meat, and they all four of them are batting it around, and all four of them have ideas, and it makes it a lot more difficult to get anything done, especially if you're an outsider. So he definitely had challenges with that, which Peter Jackson doesn't have. In quite the same way. And I've talked to somebody, this is how secret it is. I talked to somebody who talked to a friend of his who had seen it. I mean, it's like, this guy's a big agent in New York, but he didn't see it. So somebody else saw it and told him about it. And it sounds like, in his words, it will blow our minds. But I think, hyperbole aside, the trick is not looking forward to it too much. But I think any new take on this, even on this period, is something that I'm looking forward to.
I'm fascinated, too. You mentioned the radio station and your friend who had the bootleg. We were talking with Marshall Crenshaw, who grew up in the Detroit area, just a few weeks back. And he talked about, and I wonder if it's the same station, the radio station that he listened to all the time as a kid, and what an influence it was on his musical taste and then later on his songwriting.
Yeah, no, the funny thing about this was, like a high school radio station. Wow. It was operating out of Southfield, Michigan. And, you know, maybe within blocks, people could listen to it. It was that small. But this guy knew somebody, you know, it's all, it was a fairly tightly knit group. I forget even what the call letters were for it now. But he was a very, very good friend of mine. And he was just one of the disc jockeys at this little radio station, and he got it. So, yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, but Marshall went to the same high school that I did.
Oh, and I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. He was, my first year in high school was his last. So the first the first end of the year party at our high school when I was in 10th grade, Marshall was playing in the gym, not in the gym, in the dining room, the cafeteria. The band was set up in the cafeteria, and a friend of mine, Mike O'Brien, at the time was the drummer, and that was Marshall's last year there. So I didn't know him. I mean, he was in a whole other world from me. I didn't know anybody at that point.
The world is a small and wonderful place, though.
Yeah, I've never met Marshall, but we were at the same high school at the same time.
That's very cool. Do you remember where you were and what your reaction was when it became official 50-some years ago that the Beatles had broken up?
I was... the Paul quits the Beatles story. I don't really remember. My memory was that I was in London, because I was in London in the 70s a lot, but I don't think that's true. I think I must have been in Detroit, and I think, you know, as a fan, I probably had heard rumors of this, you know, but at the same time, pretty quickly, I mean, I remember the heartbreak of listening to stuff like Plastic Ono Band, and, you know, the Dream Is Over, or that whole thing. As a fan, that was hard to listen to. But for a while, what I was doing was listening to the four of them as individual players, each of them like having a discussion, you know.
Right.
That, and then, you know, with Ringo's album in 73 coming out and all three of them on it, I guess there was a period of time where I thought, I have a better memory of when they quit touring in 66.
Right.
I remember, you know, that moment of never being able, of realizing I'd never see them live. But, you know, so I guess there was a period in the early 70s where I thought, well, you know, all is not lost. You know, those of us who were fans were always looking for hints and indications that they were going to get back together again.
Did you see the story recently? I think it came from Ringo that they actually considered getting back together in 1976 for a ridiculous amount of money. But the opening act was, I guess, a man wrestling a shark. And they all thought, this just seems a little bit too strange, too shaky.
I have never heard that story. A man wrestling a shark?
Yeah.
I mean, they were always getting... Sid Bernstein was the guy in New York when I was living there in the mid-70s. He was the guy who was trying to get them back together again and offered them this massive amount of money. And that was what was, and which they said no to. I never heard the shark wrestling the guy, but
isn't that what led to the Lorne Michaels?
Exactly. That was what led to George being offered, you know, $7,500, or them being offered $7,500, and John and Paul, as it happens, were at the Dakota watching the show,
right?
And actually discussed going down in a cab and claiming their cut, which I still wish they'd done.
We're talking with Curtis Armstrong. What did you think of the Lost and Found album that was put together of Harry Nilsson's final recordings?
I think they did an incredible job with what they had, which was pretty ragged. I had heard, again, it was sort of like the Let It Be recordings. I'd heard the demos of those songs, except for Lost and Found, which I'd never heard. But I'd heard them over the years, different, you know, I found bootlegs and various stuff. But given the impossibility of, you know, having Harry be a part of it, it was, I thought, an admirable job. And I've listened to it a number of times. I think they did a great job with it.
Yeah, we had Keith on and talked about how surreal it was playing on his dad's album.
Yeah, well, the first I knew about it was I live down the street from Jim and Cynthia Keltner.
Oh,
they live on the same street. And I was at the grocery store and ran into Sin, and we were talking, and I happened to be wearing a Nilsson t-shirt at the time. And she said, oh, it's so funny, Jim was just working on the new album. And it was the first I'd heard that they were going to release it. He was obviously a very good friend of Harry's and the family. And it was only right that Keltner be there.
That's great. Great stuff. Curtis, it's always so good to talk with you. We really appreciate you making some time for us here this afternoon. Thanks as always.
Well, I appreciate it, Rich. Keep up the good work, and take care.
Thank you. Stay safe and be well. And hopefully we can all get back to work safely soon.
I hope so.
All right. Thanks, Curtis.
Take care. Bye.